This morning, we are going to look at a man who does something courageous for Jesus. Right in front of all of the eyes that are on him in the moment which we're going to observe, he does something bold, and he does it for Jesus. And I'll tell you why I want to look at this with you this morning. For this simple reason, that there are so many good things that don't happen in the world because Christians are afraid. Do you know what I mean? There are so many good things that go undone because we lack courage. Is there anyone else in here this morning who feels that that's true for them? And not only are there good things that don't happen because we Christians are afraid, there are plenty of bad things that happen, which wouldn't if we just had a little more courage. And so this morning, we're going to look together at one man who does something in front of a whole bunch of people for Jesus, and he does it with a brave, brave heart. Now, if you've been here over these last weeks, you know we are nearing the end of a series of sermons. We started about 8 weeks back in Gethsemane, the garden in which Jesus prays the night after he has communion, the Last Supper with his disciples. We began there in Gethsemane, and this series has led us from that garden to this cross. This drawing here is one of the sketches of a very famous artist. I'm sure you've heard of Rembrandt. And this is his depiction of the scene in which Jesus hangs dying on a cross, one criminal on his right and one on the left. It's quite a detailed sketch. There's a number of people in there. If I had a laser pointer, I could show you some of the details that I want you to look at. That's Will Rieger. Would you thank him for all the great work all the time? Last week, we considered the dying words of Jesus. You remember, why have you forsaken me? We learned some things from that. This week, we're going to pick up this flow of action just a few hours after Jesus dies. It was 3 o'clock in the afternoon, Matthew tells us, when he actually died. And this scene is how Rembrandt pictures it. You have Jesus and these two criminals. Here, there are soldiers. There are the members of the religious establishment standing at a bit further off. There's a centurion here. And then some of the women who follow Jesus. But in this moment, in this scene, in Matthew, there's one man whose actions are described, and they're actually described in all 4 of the scenes. And it happens at the moment that Jesus' body is taken down from the cross. This painting here is by a man named Paul Rubens. This was painted sometime in the early part of the 17th century. But what we have here is his depiction of the body of Jesus being removed from the cross. Now, there are some historical information that we have about what was going on here that's not in the scriptures. There's very little when it comes to what was actually happening when the body was taken down in the scripture, but we know this from history. There were certain attitudes that prevailed among the Romans and among the Jews as to what should happen when a person was crucified. No doubt you've heard that the Romans were brutal in their issuing justice to people. And it's true. Crucifixion was not something that was unique for Jesus. It happened quite a bit. And whenever there was a crucifixion, the Romans, they had a little bit of mercy in one way in particular. And it was that when a family member of a person who was tried and then executed on the cross, when a family member came and asked for the body after the body died, the Romans would give them the body to give it a proper burial. Now that was the standard procedure for the Romans when it came to crucifixion. But there was one exception for the Romans. And it was when a person died because they had been convicted of treason. That is, when someone presented themselves as a threat to the Roman government and they were executed because they were pretending to be a king, the Romans did not usually give the body up in that case. Instead, they left it hanging on the cross for up to a week. And they did this so that it would stand as a sign for anyone else who might try to pretend to be a king, that this is not a good idea. And they would leave it there for a week, and it would become food for the birds. Those were the Roman attitudes toward crucifixion and the bodies. Now, the Jews had their own feelings about what to do with someone who was crucified. To the Jew, a person who hung on a cross was cursed. Has anyone heard this? Maybe some of you know that in the book of Deuteronomy, in the Old Testament, in the scriptures of the Jewish people, anyone who hangs on a cross is considered cursed by God. And because of that attitude, whenever there was a crucifixion for the Jews, the body needed to be taken down before the sun set on that day. Now think of this moment. It's 3:00 in the afternoon when Jesus dies. The sun begins to go down. And every religious person there who had watched him die would know that his body needs to come down before sunset. You've heard of the word Sabbath, haven't you? Sabbath begins. Anyone know when Sabbath actually begins for the Jews? Sundown, the day before what we would call Sabbath. For the Jews, Sabbath was on Saturday. This happened on a Friday that Jesus died at 3:00. And for the in the mind of the Jewish people, the next day begins not at midnight or in the morning when you wake up, but it actually begins at sundown. That's when the day starts. And so when Jesus died on the cross, all of those religious folks who were there, they would have seen him die at 3:00 and known that his body needs to come down before sundown, because on Sabbath, you're not allowed to do any work. And to take a body down would be work. There's one more reason why it was extremely important in this case here, with Jesus at this moment, why his body should come down. Anybody know what celebration was happening in Jerusalem? Yes.
Passover.
Passover is one of the most holy celebrations for the Jewish people. And if there was to be a body hanging on the cross overnight, from their perspective, that would be absolutely atrocious, because it would foul up the holiness of the entire city and ruin the celebration. And so there was no question that when it came time, that sunset came around, this body had to come down. And so it would have been urgent for those who were there at the cross, who were Jewish and who cared about their faith, to make sure this body came down from the cross before sunset. Now there's one more thing you have to know before we continue, and it's this. I said that for the Romans, when someone was tried for treason, they were usually left up there. In Jesus' case, for the Jews, he was convicted of blasphemy. That is, he was condemned by the Jews because they believed he was pretending to be God. And there was an attitude that Jews had towards someone who did that was very, very condemning. And it worked itself out in this way. When this body was taken down, instead of being given a traditional, an honorable or a respectable burial, it was to be given the burial of a criminal. We can read this in the works of a man named Josephus. I've spoken of him before. He was a Jewish historian who wrote about these days. Here's how he puts it. When a person was crucified for blasphemy, they should be buried ignominiously and in obscurity. Isn't that fantastic? Ignominiously. It's a good word, right? It means that Jesus' body was to be taken down and buried like an animal. In the northeastern corner of Jerusalem, there was a valley that came together where the people threw their garbage. And when a criminal was crucified like that, everyone who was there, who wanted his body down, would know that it should be taken down, dragged outside of the city gate, and thrown into the valley where the garbage was placed. Because in their minds, that's what it was worth. Now, this is the moment where we meet the man who does something brave, who I want to look at with you. Now look at this painting again. Here we have the women. And in the Gospels, they're always there, which says quite a bit. And we'll talk about that another time. There's two men here, and I believe I know who both of these are. And this man here, I'm not sure. And I don't know, but I would imagine Rubens meant to say something symbolically with this man in the way he's holding Jesus' arm. But this man here is a man called Nicodemus, because he's mentioned in the book of John alone as helping Jesus down. And this man here, does anybody know who he is? Joseph of Arimathea. In all four Gospels, we meet this man, Joseph of Arimathea, right at the end of Jesus' life. That's the moment when we see him. And what's happening here is extraordinary, and we will see it when we understand something about this particular man, Joseph of Arimathea. Now, I want to tell you what we know about him. Because if we don't know all of the details that we have about him, we'll miss what's happening here and how amazing it really is. Here's the first thing that we know about Joseph of Arimathea. If we go to the book of Mark and we find the place where he's mentioned there, we learn that he was a respected member of the Sanhedrin. Now, the Sanhedrin was sort of like the Supreme Court in Jerusalem. It was a group made up of 71 men, chief priests, elders, that's important old guys, and scribes. These were law experts. These 71 together were responsible for making judgments whenever there was a juridical procedure that needed to take place. When someone was in trouble and there needed to be a trial, they would hear the evidence and make a decision based on what they heard. Now, it was especially important if there was ever a case that required capital punishment. That is to say that somebody was guilty or accused of something that said they should die. If that happened, the Sanhedrin was the member of people who heard the case and made the judgment. Now, those of you who are here, do you remember what happened to Jesus after he was arrested in the garden? Where he was brought? He was brought to Caiaphas' house. He was the chief priest, and he was put on trial before a group of men on that night who wanted to find out if they could sentence him to death. Do you remember this? That group was called the Sanhedrin. This guy, right here, Joseph of Arimathea, was a respected member of that council. Now, does anybody remember the details of what happened during that trial? It's a little fishy, isn't it? The first thing that makes the trial of Jesus that night fishy is that instead of meeting to see evidence in order to decide what to do to Jesus, they met because they had already decided to do what to do with Jesus. They decided to kill him. They had the sentence in mind, and so they met to come together to put some sort of evidence on him so that they wouldn't look so bad when they sentenced him to death. That was one reason why it was fishy. There were other reasons too. The procedures that we can read about in other sources for the Sanhedrin tell us that it was illegal to have trials on celebrations of Passover, so they broke that rule. It was illegal to have trials at night. They had it in the middle of the night. It was against their own rules to try a man to death unless they had two meetings, and they only had one. So in all of these ways, it was a crooked undertaking. And anyone would see that. And Mark tells us that Joseph was a respected member of that council. Now, there's some more information we have from him. If we go to the book of Luke and we see where Joseph is mentioned there, Luke tells us that even though he was a member of this group, he did not agree with their decision and their plan. Now, tell me if I'm right. I assume that all of you also would have, like him, disagreed with their decision. Is that true? I'm serious. You can show me with a nod or something. Yeah. He was there, and he didn't share their opinions. Now, look at this painting here. This is Van Hanthorst, the Dutch painter. This is his depiction of what that looked like, that scene, where Jesus stood before the chief priest and was questioned. Now, I want you to imagine for a moment that you yourself were in that room as this trial was going on. Joseph of Arimathea, we understand, was. He, like these men here who are depicted in the background, he stood and watched as false evidence was planted on Jesus. He sat there in the shadows and saw that this group of men, who was put together for a good purpose, to make judgments, had actually gone from being a good council to something wicked. He stood there and observed as Jesus was put on trial. And in his mind, he thought, this is not right. And not only did he think it in his mind, he felt it in his heart. He looked at what they were doing to Jesus, and it turned his stomach. He saw this innocent man, Jesus, standing before this group, and he knew deep down inside that this was not right. It was wrong. He didn't agree with them when they decided to send Jesus to the cross. He did not share their opinion. Can you identify with him? Now listen. Before he becomes someone that you want to look up to, I have to tell you this other thing. We do not learn from Luke that he disagreed with this moment until after Jesus was dead. And you know why? Even though he was there and didn't agree with it, he said nothing. He stood there watching this thing and knew it was wrong, and he kept his opinion about it to himself. As he stood in the shadows, observing this injustice, and it occurred to him in his mind, and he felt it in his heart that this was wrong, he made a conscious choice not to say anything or to do anything at all to stop it. Let me ask you this, and I want you to be honest with yourself. Have you ever done that? Have you ever been in a place where you know what the right thing is to do, but you choose not to do it? Where you know that there is something that ought to be said, but you choose to keep your mouth shut. Have you done that ever? Maybe you're with a new acquaintance. Someone you're just getting to know. And in conversation, they mention something about those crazy Christians. And you choose not to let on that you also are a Christian. Maybe an old friend is telling you yet another story of drinking too much late at night, all alone. And as you listen, in your mind, you're already formulating what you should say. You drink too much. You've got a problem. God didn't make you for this. But instead of saying anything, you keep quiet. And you laugh approvingly at the end of their story. Maybe you see one more time that person who's all alone at work, in your neighborhood, at school in the cafeteria, and in your mind you think, I should go say hello to that person. Maybe it's even at the end of church at Orb. It occurs to you, I should reach out to them. Maybe I should invite them to my house. Maybe I should say hello to her. She's alone. Maybe I should bring him into my home. I should be hospitable. But that's as far as it goes. You never let that thought in your mind turn into any action. Why do we do this? Why? I think there's a one-word answer for it. Fear. Because we're afraid of what will happen if we let on that we also are a follower of this man Christ. Is there anyone else who does this? By the time I was a sophomore in college, and I'm actually not in college anymore. I've been accused of looking young. I'm trying to change that. By the time I was a sophomore in college, I was an expert at hiding whatever good was in me. There was a group of guys that I became friends with, that I lived with, and they were my roommates in my dorm and whatnot. And if you told anyone, if I was accused, if it became illegal to be a Christian at Rutgers College, and I was accused of being a Christian, I could call every one of them to vouch for me that I wasn't, and they would have given the best testimony because I looked nothing like a Christian. All of my faith was on the inside. One night we were going together to dinner, as we always did. We were walking in a group, and as we came into Davidson Dining Hall. Anybody else go to Rutgers? I see some grimaces on the face, which means you know, because you've eaten there. We walked into Davidson Dining Hall, and we rounded the corner, and as we came forward, myself and this group of friends, there was a table, and there was a guy sitting at the table, and he had a little sign on it, and it said, "Do you believe in God?" And this guy had a big smile on his face. He was dressed with a nice shirt, and he kind of looked at us, and I saw all my friends look at this guy. And I saw the smirks immediately come onto their faces. As we walked up, he said, "Hey, fellas, want to fill out a questionnaire?" And he smiled real big. And one of the guys in our group just looked at him and went, "Bah!" He started laughing. All of us, including myself, burst into laughter. That's what was going on the outside. Do you know what was going on the inside of me? I felt so awful. Because I knew that I said I believed in God. And at the same time, I knew that everything I was showing outwardly said I did not. And I laughed with them, and I walked away from that man all the way toward the dining hall. Now, I was such a coward. I felt so bad inside that I did this, I pretended that I had forgotten my meal card. And so I said to my friends, "Oh, hey guys, I'll meet up with you. I have to go back to the room to get my meal card." I ran out, and I didn't go talk to the guy right away because I knew it wouldn't take long enough. So I ran all the way back to my room as if I really had to go there. I came back, and I made sure nobody was around, and I sat down and I told the guy, "I actually do believe in God." And I filled out a little card that said where I lived and that maybe I was interested in a Bible study. And I gave it to him, and I ran back in, and I hid that from all of the guys in there. Now, I have a feeling, and I'm not glad for this, but that I'm not the only person in this room who's prone to that sort of action. Are you aware of the ways in which you today even hide the fact that you also are a disciple? Are you? Now, this is where this figure of Joseph that we've singled out this morning, where he becomes very helpful to us, because this is what John tells us about why he didn't say anything. Look what it says there. John tells us that the reason that he didn't speak up is that he was a secret disciple because of fear. He was afraid. And he tells us what he was afraid of, too. We know that if he spoke up, there would be consequences. That if he made it known that he was a follower of Jesus, that something bad would happen. We can see this, that it wasn't only Joseph who was afraid to show that he was a disciple. Earlier on in John, in chapter 12, it's this fantastic passage. Jesus is teaching, and he's coming up against resistance, as he did so often, and the leaders are rejecting him. And John stops and tells us why. And look what it says there. He tells us that many, even of the authorities, believed in him. That is, there were lots of people as Jesus was going about, who believed in him, including many of the authorities. Again, one of whom was this Joseph of Arimathea. However, because of the Pharisees, they did not confess it for fear that they would be put out of the synagogue. That is, leaders in that day knew that if I admit that I believe in this man also, there will be consequences, and the consequences will be that I will be put out of the synagogue. In Joseph of Arimathea's case, it means that during that trial, if he speaks up among those 71 men and says, I don't agree, he is going to lose 70 of his closest friends, his business associates, he's going to lose his job, he's going to become the object of ridicule, he will be put out of the economic, social, and religious life of his day. In other words, if he confesses Jesus at that moment, he'll lose everything. And he doesn't want to lose everything, so he keeps his mouth shut. And John tells us that he wasn't the only one who was like that. People were afraid to say that they believed in Jesus, and then he goes on to tell us why. They loved human glory more than the glory that comes from God. I will tell you that when I came across this verse, and it was not until years after that moment at Rutgers, this described me perfectly. I cared more about the glory that would come from human beings. And looking back on it, it's so foolish. I mean, those guys were all right, but the glory that came from them was so fleeting. All I had to do is, how do I put this? I had a fart louder than anyone else, and I got the glory. I mean, it's crude, and you think, why would he say this? We're in a... Well, we're not in a sanctuary, we're in a movie theater. But yet, how can he say such a gross thing? That's just the thing. That's the only thing I can say about what human glory really is worth. You, and this is the truth, you are much more likely to get glory from human beings in this life that you live if you pretend you don't follow Jesus. Just like I was a lot more likely to get glory at Rutgers from the guys that I was friends with if I just kept the fact that I was a Christian hidden from them. I would get a lot more glory from them. But the truth is, that glory is garbage. That's what it is. All of the glory that the world can give is nothing at all when it's placed beside the glory that comes from God, which in the eyes of man looks like nothing. But it is something that is perfect and good. And it's not just that if you would follow Jesus and share with the world that you are one of his disciples, you would get something good for you. That's not how the glory of God works. Do you know that? Do you know where the glory of God is most perfectly manifest? It's most perfectly manifest in a king who rules dying on a cross with a crown made of thorns. His throne is not gilded in gold and bespeckled with jewels. It's an instrument of Roman torture. That's what the glory of God looks like. And when the world sees that, it doesn't see something that's worth anything. But let me tell you this, and this is for every one of you who would follow Jesus. And I want to say, I know that there are some people in here, and I'm glad for this, who come because someone dragged them and they're not sure that they want to follow Jesus. And if that's where you are, that's okay. You are welcome here. But for those of us who do follow Jesus, if we would decide to give up seeking after human glory and instead let it all go away. All of the good things that we would get if we continued hiding our discipleship. If we decided to let go of all of that and instead seek after the glory that God gives, it would be good for you, for each one of us, for us as a church, and more importantly, for the world that God loves so much. The glory that God gives can easily become something that you seek after because you're selfish, and then it stops being what it is. Now this is where Joseph of Arimathea becomes extremely important for us. In this moment here, as Jesus is dying on the cross, Rembrandt's scene depicts these two men. You see these two men here? It may be hard for you to see, but these men are dressed just like Joseph of Arimathea is in the other painting because they're also members of the Sanhedrin. As Jesus was dying there on the cross, all of those men would have been there. They watch the criminal in their eyes that they've condemned dying there. And as they gaze on him expiring, the thought in each one of their minds is, who's going to take this body down and throw it in the garbage? And right then, in that moment, there is a man among them who approaches the cross. And you know who it is? It's Joseph of Arimathea. Now, this would not yet be surprising to them to see him going there because they would have anticipated that he was going to take the body and be in charge of bringing it to the place where it would be dumped. Now, if you want to follow along, you certainly can. This is in John chapter 19, but this is the moment where we see what he does. And I've skipped, I'm sorry. This is what John tells us. After Jesus dies, Joseph of Arimathea, who was a disciple of Jesus, though a secret one because of his fear of the Jews, asked Pilate to let him take away the body of Jesus. Pilate gave him permission, so he came and removed the body. And we know that Joseph was a rich man. He had his own piece of property right in Jerusalem with his own stone grave. These were the graves that were reserved for very, very important people. Perhaps he had some influence so that Pilate would agree to let him take the body down early. But he went and asked to take the body down. So far, there's nothing surprising. But watch what happens next. As those members of the Sanhedrin would have expected to see one of their own take this body down to dispose of it in the shameful way they had hoped, this is what happens. Nicodemus, who had at first come to Jesus by night, also came, bringing a mixture of myrrh and aloes. Myrrh and aloes were the materials that were used to prepare a body for burial. Not to prepare a criminal's body to be thrown out, but to prepare a body that mattered to the person who brought it for a burial. Not only did he bring myrrh and aloes, look what it says there, weighing about 100 pounds. This stuff was extremely expensive. It was not cheap. 100 pounds is an extraordinarily extravagant amount. So if two men came to take a body down with that much embalming material, it could only mean one thing. It meant that to those men who were taking that body belonged to royalty. And not only did they bring the myrrh and the aloes, but they took the body down and they wrapped it with linen cloths that they prepared with the spices. And then these men, according to the burial custom of the Jews, they treated this body that was in the eyes of that group, the body of a criminal, they treated it like a king. They prepared it for burial, they wrapped it, and they brought it to the grave where it would be placed in a place of dignity and honor and respect. Now, look at Joseph right here. In this moment, right in front of everyone, in front of all of the eyes of the men who think that Jesus is worthless, he does this thing that tells them all something, not just with his words, because it's easy to say something. Like I could have that day said to my friends, hey, I'm a Christian, what's wrong with that? And then just gone on living like I did. To be brave in front of people with your faith is not a matter of just saying something. Joseph did something with his actions that said to all who were there to see, this man here that you have killed, I also follow him. He is to me a king, and so I will treat his body accordingly. Do you see that brave thing he did? Do you know what would happen because of this? He would lose everything. But it didn't matter to him. Because something took place when he saw Jesus up there that changed him. So that he could see this scene here and say, I don't care what I lose for admitting with my actions, that I also am a follower of this man's. What did he see? What did he see that changed him? And I'll tell you why I'm asking this. I'm not just asking this because it's interesting to think about Joseph of Arimathea. I'm asking this because if you or if I, if your eyes or if my eyes saw what he saw here, maybe it would inspire us too to be brave and courageous. Not just for us, but to do something good for Jesus. To do something good for this world that so badly needs people who will do something good for Jesus. What did he see? Do you know what he saw? Listen, think of this. As he stood there in that crowd and his eyes gazed up upon the man who was dying on the cross, this is what Joseph of Arimathea saw, first of all. He saw that there's a man there dying in part because of me. He had to know that. He hadn't yet spoken up. He stood there with the rest of the Sanhedrin and he saw quite clearly that that man who's dying there, he is there in part because I chose not to say anything. Can you imagine what that would feel like? Wouldn't that make you feel full of guilt? He stood there watching that. And then he looked at Jesus. It doesn't say this in the scriptures, but I believe we can say this. I imagine that he noticed that Jesus' eyes, as they were gazing up at heaven, then looked down at him. And when he met eyes with Jesus, do you know what Jesus' eyes conveyed to him? Listen to this. We know this because it's all over every word of the New Testament. Jesus' eyes did not convey condemnation toward him or hatred or anger, but Jesus' eyes were filled with love as they looked upon this man who bore the guilt of his death, just as everybody else in that crowd did, just as you yourself do. And I do too. And as Joseph lifted his guilty eyes to see Jesus, he saw the eyes of love incarnate staring back at him. And I believe that in that moment, God, through the power of his Spirit, conveyed right into the heart of that guilty man this sense that not only is this man dying because of you, but he's dying for you. And he's dying for you not because you've done anything to deserve it, not because you've made yourself good, not because you spoke up. You didn't speak up. He's dying for you because he's good and because he loves you. And this, my friend, is true of everyone in this movie theater. It's true of all of you here and everyone outside of these doors and every person that you'll meet after the service today and every person you'll interact with for the rest of the week, that Jesus Christ looks upon them and he loves them and he laid his life down for them. And I believe that when Joseph saw that and it hit him in his mind that this good man here, even though I should have spoken up and didn't, still chose to die for me, if he could give so much for me and be so brave and so courageous and so selfless for me, how could I not also be selfless for him? How could I not also be brave for him? If he was willing to lay down everything he had for me, how could I not lay down my reputation before this group of men for him? And so he left that crowd and he walked with courage right up to Jesus' body. He took it down and he prepared it for burial like it was a king's body. Here's how it's put in Romans. Listen now, this is from Romans chapter 5. Rarely will anyone dare to die for a righteous person, though perhaps for a good man someone might dare to die. But God shows his love for us in that while we were weak, weak there means too afraid to admit we're Christians, too scared to say the thing to our friends that they need to hear that has some faith in it because we follow Jesus and we know they matter more to God. Too weak to admit that we're Christians with the way we reach out to people who are strangers, to love people who are unlovable. We're too weak to live really as Christians because if we were stronger, we would go love those people who nobody reaches out to. We would not just be Christians on Sunday evening or Sunday morning in the movie theater, but all week long. It says, while we were yet weak, while Joseph of Arimathea was yet weak, God chose to die for us. That is what this means. All that we've been talking about, from Gethsemane to Calvary, every moment of it, all of the agony that Jesus endured, all that he did for you and for me and for all people. Because he loves us, and because he chose to lay everything down for us. Now, this is what would be good. If you, and if I, and together as a group, this church, chose to be brave. To be brave in following Jesus and doing good for him in this world. Not being ashamed of who we are as his followers. Not just with our words, but with our actions, carrying the love of that man, Jesus Christ, into this world that so desperately needs it. If there was one result from spending time together as we have over these last 2 months for me, it would be that we would have seen this good thing that Jesus did for us and for the world, and it would change us. Let's pray together.